Sean. Hey, Radcast is on.
And welcome to the show, Mr. Jim Zumbo.
Gentlemen, I am pleased to be here, and I use that term loosely when I say gentlemen.
Al Winder. Just want to welcome you to the show. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with us on a podcast for a little bit.
Hey, I'm looking forward to it. There's nothing makes me happier than a cold in Minnesota. If I can't be out fishing, I should be talking about fishing.
Hailing from Wisconsin, Jana Waller.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Radcast. Hunting, fishing, and everything in between. Powered by Bow Spider.
Brought to you by PK Lures and High Mountain Seasonings.
And now, here's your hosts, Patrick Edwards and David Merrill.
Today, I have the immense pleasure of introducing a guy that I've wanted to visit with for years. He's very well known in North America and across the world for muskie and pike fishing. He was named by Outdoor Life magazine as one of the top 20 anglers on the planet. You've probably seen him on Outdoor Life TV and a number of other channels on YouTube, doing stuff with Bass Pro Shop, Eagle Claw, Clam Outdoors, you name it. But Mr. Pete Mana, thank you so much for coming on to talk about muskies today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, I have to say. Thanks for inviting me. And actually, I'm wouldn't really talk muskies, but I like to hunt too. So that sounds like quite an...
Yeah, and he's super amped up about it. He, about a week beforehand, I think he started losing sleep like you and I do before we go on muskie trips. And he's super amped up about it. So he's on his way now, and he talks about for the hunter, the ultimate experience is going after those dall sheep. And I could say for freshwater angling, I would say the ultimate is going after muskies. And you've been doing this for many years and doing it really well. Like I said, I've enjoyed reading your articles. And just tell us all just the story of where you grew up and how you got into muskie fishing.
Lucky guy. I was born in Chicago, but 6 months old, my folks decided to buy a resort in Hayward, Wisconsin on the Spider Lake chain of lakes here. And they owned that and ran it for 11 years. And in those days, it was, you know, fishing, period. And there was no recreational activity. That's what everybody did. And so I grew up on a fishing resort, and the rest was up to God. I just wired, you knew it early on. If I was ever in trouble as a kid at the resort, it was because I was fishing instead of doing what I was supposed to be doing, my little chores. Yeah, it's just, and I got to say, it's interesting on that topic. My dad, Tex, and I were fishing about a week ago. And we're on a little lake, and I kind of talked to my dad about it. I compared myself, obviously, quite a few years prior to this little girl. Dad, mom working in the yard, this little gal sitting on a dock, and she was fishing. And she was sticking right to it and catching her own. She couldn't have been more than 5 years old. And she was taking her own fish off, baiting her own hook, and sitting there catching fish. And I thought, yep. I can certainly understand that.
Yep.
Because that's, yeah, I think you're just wired that way. And that was definitely me early on. And the last year of my dad owning the resort, I actually did my first guiding. He had a guide cancel for whatever reason. And I told the guy, my kid's got a strong back and he knows a few spots. Of course, it was rolling in those days. That's where the strong back comes in as far as boat position. And I went out and guided somebody, and the guy actually caught a muskie, and gosh, I was a hero. I got a pocket knife for a tip and a little bit of money. I was more concerned about the pocket knife than the money at the time. I thought that was pretty neat, but that kind of was the start of it. And then a few years later, we had moved, but I got a job guiding in the summers at a fishing resort where the boat and stuff was provided, and I could just ride my bicycle over there. So I started guiding at that age and was supposed to go to college, decided that wasn't a very good thing to do. I'd rather fish. So I just kept on guiding with no specific plan necessarily, other than I wanted to fish and guide, and I understood that I had to figure out how to make a living doing that. So I fished and guided like crazy, did a lot of other things for the first 10 years. Of course, you don't have any money and you're buying lures as fast as you can. And so I troweled concrete and pounded nails and did a little bit of everything from bartending to whatever. And it just kind of, I never had a grand plan, but I really had, I was on my own then, and it was pretty much booked up that early already. I did pretty well. And then I pushed myself because personally, the muskies were the hardest thing to catch. I had enough business, and I personally got more interested in that and took it on as a challenge. And I switched over to, with the exception of the month of May, muskies only, after that with my clientele. And I think that was just it, that single decision and taking on that challenge and basically fishing 16 hours a day every day. I caught a lot of fish and got recognized. I got to the point of where if anybody came to the Hayward, Wisconsin area to muskie fish, the resorts would say, well, if you want to catch a muskie, this young guy, he's got a lot of hair, but he sure catches them. And it all just went from there, having television opportunities and seminars. And I was asked to start writing articles, which I found pretty unbelievable. It was interesting because I ignored typing classes in high school, and then I literally had to teach myself to type because I'd never taken a course. And just a gradual progression. In reality, it was all just the way I was raised and the way I was wired to.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. As far as, I think people get bit by the musky bug, and the reason I say that is, I mean, I have not caught a true muskie yet, just because we don't have access to them really here. In Wyoming, catching hybrids, there's something about catching those fish that it ruins you. And that's what Danny Curla had told me. He said, you catch one of these things, it's going to ruin you. Because something, there's like a switch that goes off in your brain of, that was really cool, that was really fun, I want to do that again. And so I have a feeling for you, it's the same thing, right?
Yeah, it was interesting. I had no real favorite the high school days. Right. I did everything, and crappies and walleyes and bass, and were good enough for me as muskies, but there was something that just snapped when I got out. I was in a position, being busy enough anyway, to switch over. And then what that allows you to do too, just like anything else, if you're playing team different sports, but then all of a sudden you suddenly concentrate on one, when you're just completely targeting that single species and following everything that happens and trying to piece it all together, yeah, you just really do get dialed. And I do have to say that in those days, it was really a lot different. The technology and the information and everything has changed so much that when I look at it now and I look back then, it would be really hard to stand out these days, because there's so many really good anglers. Mm-hmm. Anybody that's fired, I was, and I'm sure you are, and Danny is, they're out there and they're good. The level of the average angler is really pretty exceptional these days. Back then, it was a lot easier to stand out, to be honest. There were one of the things that seems simplistic these days was I would fish oddball spots, and there weren't a lot of people targeting fish mid-lake breed, especially deeper stuff, deeper rocks and that kind of thing. It was more or less just the saying anything bad against anybody, but they was more or less shoreline fishing. And so if you were really going at it like I was and really exploring the limits in a lot of bodies of water around here, I was literally doing some things that nobody else was doing just structurally. And then when you're putting in those kind of hours targeting that one species all the time, that really made a big difference.
Yeah, and I don't know if you can touch on this a little bit, but muskie fishing is not the same as going rainbow trout fishing or walleye fishing or anything like that. It's a different ball game. And so I don't know if you could speak to that a little bit, just how different it is than other styles of fishing.
But just one of the things about muskie fishing is the day-to-day patterning, because there's so few out there. You can't necessarily try a lure for 5 minutes and say anything, right? It's a whole different ball game in that respect, or try a certain type of structure for a half hour and say they're not on the rocks. You try a couple of rock spots, or you try a green cabbage, red cabbage, whatever, pick your weed type, give that a try, and hoping to either find out that they're there or hope hoping to eliminate it as a place where muskies are hanging and active on that particular day. It just requires so much more time from that standpoint of patterning everything about it. And then you get into lure types and you get into the speed. Do they like a fast retrieve, a slow retrieve? Are they in the mood for erratic stuff? Certain depth levels, top water, there's just a tremendous amount of different options. And when you're dealing with a low density critter, it's just harder to put all those pieces together. And I would say that if there was a single thing that I got to be really good at with all of the hours on the water, it was that alone. It's just the day-to-day stuff of trying to figure out where they are and maybe where the active ones are. I really believe in that as well. At times, I think you're probably fishing over muskies in a lot of cases, but there's certain patterns to where the active fish are going and what they're feeding on for whatever reason. I think that's one thing, even with all the technology and stuff that we have these days, that one particular point we'll probably never figure out completely what it is that triggers the active fish in the system on a given day. Even a real tough day, I think there's always something, there's always a way, it's always possible to catch one if you find the right pattern, if you find the group of fish that are active. And then, unfortunately, you also got to figure out what it is if that's triggering them on a tough day like that. The reality is you do get the perfect weather at times, and those are those rare days where everything's just going right, and a lot of times there's really not even a pattern structurally to a certain extent. And when they're hot, it's weird. They can be so hard to catch, but at times it almost seems like you could throw your sock in the water and catch one. There are days where there is really no particular pattern on lure type. On my guiding days, one of the things I learned early on, you never start a day regardless of what happened the day before. You don't start a day with everybody throwing a bucktail, even if the day before you caught them all on bucktails. And I would always start off with the guy in the front using what I thought in my head from prior experience and current weather was highest percentage lure that they're most likely to bite and go on down the line. And the guy in the back of the boat, which was always me, I guess, I would just be trying different things to test the waters. And you go through that process every given day of trying to figure out what they're in the mood for, where they're located. And these days, in a lot of cases, you can actually see them with side imaging and stuff like that. But in a lot of cases, you might know fish are there, but they're just literally not active. Sometimes you actually can see that visually. In some cases, in clear water and sight fishing, there's fish you just can't make a move. And that's a pattern you got to forget about and try something else, find something else where those fish may be willing to eat. So it's a chess game all the time. To me, that's one of the funner things about it, though. Tough as they are and frustrating as they are at times, just that challenge to try and figure out what's going on. And then combine that with potential feeding windows, probable feeding windows, which is barometric pressure changes and moon and lunar influences, and take full advantage of those kind of things when they do occur. That's the next level of being real effective out there on the water, because in a lot of cases, there's a lot of long hours where fish are pretty tough, but if you got them located, you got things dialed in a little bit, and then you have a window of activity open up. Being aware of everything about it and knowing it's a window so that you're maximizing that time period to catch as many of those fish as you can. Catch them and you want to enjoy the moment, maybe get a quick picture and that kind of thing, but boy, you got to get right back at it. You got to be on the same pattern. I learned a long time ago, boy, it's more common if you're on bigger water, but if there's a probable window coming, whether it be a predictable lunar activity or barometric pressure changes, you do not want to be driving down the lake on a long run during, in a lot of cases, especially in big water where the water's rough, you can take a 30-minute run. If you do that at the wrong time, you're not paying attention to things, you may completely miss a good feeding window because you decided, I didn't catch anything there, I'm going to drive to this spot over here, but it takes you a half hour to get there and you miss the whole thing.
So for muskies, what's for barometric pressure or moon phases, what do you typically look for there?
Generally, a dropping barometer is better. A moving barometer is to me, just in general, better. But I like to see a frontal activity coming in, and preferably fairly slow, and obviously not electric. That's always a tough one to deal with. But that's usually the ideal situation. And generally, the feeding window is going to come prior as that barometric pressure is dropping and you see the front moving in. That's generally going to be the time. But in a lot of cases, too, it'll be after. And that's one thing people should remember. If you do get, generally, this is more common with the fronts that have some electricity to them. One thing about it, if you bail, and that's a smart thing to do, there's no sense getting hit to catch a fish, but try and, as soon as you think it's safe, if you're, you know, at the boat landing or at your dock or whatever, try and get right back out again, especially if you didn't experience a feeding window prior. If there was a front coming in and nothing happened prior, odds are there's going to be a window after, and that's something I learned, that you obviously still want to be safe, but as soon as you think you are safe, get back out there and get after it, because in a lot of cases, that window will come after. Now, when you get the weather, in my opinion, trumps lunar stuff, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. I generally don't pay much attention to the lunar stuff when you've got crazy weather, when you've got frontal activity all day. I don't even necessarily worry about it. I'm just trying to play the weather. But when you got steady weather, it doesn't matter if it's sun or clouds or whatever, but if everything's fairly steady, the wind direction is steady, feet, the whole nine yards, those are generally the days where you really want to pay attention to that lunar stuff. You absolutely do not want to be taking that long run when the moon's underfoot or rising, setting. You definitely want to make sure you're on spots then. And a lot of people are pretty persnickety about lunchtime or whatever time eating. The moon sets at right dead on noon. Don't be eating a sandwich then, unless you're trolling. Thanks.
Yeah, I know for walleyes, typically when it's a full moon phase and the moon's just starting to crest, that's typically when I get a lot of hits in pretty rapid succession as they start to feed. And it's, again, one of those things where you better have your line in the water. You're going to miss out on the best bite, and it may last 10 minutes and be over. And so it's important to be ready. So that's good insight. I was curious what you thought about that. And another thing, just shift gears just a little bit, is it just anecdotally for me, it looks like more people are beginning to get that musky bug and that musky fever and pursue muskies, especially for catch and release. And so why do you think it is that there's, and maybe you see a different trend, but is that true that more people are doing it, and why would that be?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No doubt more doing it, to the point of actually being surprising. If I would have guessed 20 years ago that there would be this many people doing it and that much interest, part of it's, I think, to a certain extent, social media, I think, may have something to do with it, too. There's something about that mystique that you talked about at first, of the toughest fish to catch and all of that. And I do think that when people are looking around on social media, yeah, it's nice to see a walleye, it's nice to see a bass, but all of a sudden they see somebody holding a great big toothy critter, and they just, something clicks, and that's ego or whatever combination of things hit you. The least interest, you go, that's a big fish. And boy, it's got a whole bunch of teeth. Be nice to catch one of those. And it's one of those things that it's not for everybody. It's interesting over the years, all the guiding and stuff I've done. There were people that were out in the boat and really seemed to enjoy it and that kind of thing. But the bug doesn't hit everybody. Mm-hmm. And there's some that'll go right back to mainly bass fishing or mainly walleye fishing and that type of thing. But other people, it hits them like it hit me and other folks like Danny. You just go, ooh, this is, you focus in on it. And then, in a way, I don't know if I should be happy for him or feel sad. You get addicted to it. And in a way, that is sad to a certain extent. In recent years, I've backed off a bit and actually been able to enjoy bass and walleye and other stuff a little more that I don't have to be catching muskies only, and I've really gotten back to enjoying all types of fishing just a little bit more. I've always enjoyed it all. People get to taking it personally. If it hits you like that, it is an obsession. There's no doubt. You buy too many lures, you spend way too much time and money doing it, but there's something about it that just hooks you. And I still to this day, you know, when people say, why did you pick them and what about muskies has still really got you? I will say it's different with all other species in freshwater anyway. I enjoy them and truly love bluegills and crappies, and I find myself giggling and having a great time. But the muskies shock you, and part of it's that low density thing. And there's something about that. With all of the fish I've caught, you still get excited. There's that rush because you haven't seen anything for hours. There's something about that, and then all of a sudden, here's the big fish, and there they are. And I had to laugh. It was literally just 3 days ago. I haven't been doing much musky fishing because of the heat over the summer here, but I just toyed with them a little bit here the last few days, and I had a fish come up on a topwater lure, glider bait, and I've seen this before in calm water where they just suck it and literally pull it down, and I hadn't seen a fish in, I don't know, 3 hours, and that fish, I was convinced had it, and I set the hook and pulled it away from it.
Yep.
And I thought, after all these years, you should know better. They still do it to you. They freak you out, and that's the part I love about it.
So there's a similar story I have. The very first encounter I had with muskies was with hybrids here in Wyoming, and we had a lake that the water is super clear. You can see 30 feet, 40 feet down, really crystal clear water. And so I went there and I was trying to catch my first tiger muskie. And I'd been using a bait that Danny had recommended, and I was working it, and I saw this big dark thing behind my lure. And it just looked like a log out there floating. And I was twitching that lure, and it came a little bit closer to the boat, and that log just kept falling. And then I realized it was a tiger muskie. And he just sat there next to the boat looking at me. And my adrenaline was just through the roof at that point. And I was so frustrated because he wouldn't hit it. And he was probably 38, 40 inches, something like that. But he just wouldn't hit it. Fishing another hour, haven't seen another fish. I throw into this spot and I'm working the lure back. And I see this muskie come charging after it. And it was a nice one. And the lure was on the surface because it was a topwater lure. Same thing. I saw him come up, but his mouth was open. And I didn't wait for the weight of the fish on the lure. And I set the hook and I pulled it right out of his mouth. And that, because I couldn't go again, I was in high school, I couldn't go again for another year to go tiger muskie fishing. That seriously bothered me for a year. Like it drove me nuts that I had done that. And I had pulled it out of his mouth. I was so mad at myself. I was so frustrated. But they do that to you. They do it. It's just, it's crazy. But I think that's part of... Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah, I can tell you this. I guess I don't know exactly how old you are, but one of the few good things about age, it doesn't bother you, or at least in my case. I don't like it when I embarrass myself and do things like the story I just told you. I've been doing it so many years, but yeah, it used to. I'd lay awake at night and lose a big fish or mess one up. That always has bugged me back then and still to this day. When you didn't do anything wrong and you wouldn't have done it any different if you had it to do over again, that's fishing, right? But when you did something wrong, that you should know better. And if you combine that with a real big one and you don't get it because of your own stupidity, that's kind of hard to take.
Yeah, it is. And especially, I knew I wasn't going to have another opportunity for quite a while, and it just killed me. And that night, I didn't sleep. I was so mad. And I just kept having visions of that fish swimming off after that. And I was like, oh man, I can't believe I did that. That's part of what makes you also go back and try to do better the next time. But I do want to ask you that because there are so many people getting into the sport, one of the things that I have a hard time watching is people think, I'm going to go catch a muskie. And these hybrid muskies to me seem like they're a little bit easier to catch. They're a little bit more ready to just hammer something. I think it's the pike side of them that gives them that. They're always looking for something to eat, it seems. But people catch one, but then they realize, okay, now I've caught this thing and I don't know how to unhook it without getting hooked by these huge hooks or these teeth. And I don't know how to, to handle this fish properly. So you see people grabbing them incorrectly or holding them in a terrible position, keeping them out of water too long. What advice would you give to the person that wants to go pursue muskies? What advice do you give them before they go out and actually try to catch one?
That's real important, without a doubt, and to a certain extent, somewhat of a frustrating topic, I guess, in a way, because it seems like a lot of people don't want to take that preparation, and I guess I understand it, because the desire to catch the fish and get the hot lure and this kind of thing is, you know, more exciting than the whole idea of, you know, trying to be responsible and really learning how to handle the fish and be prepared for the whole situation. There really isn't enough of that, and as much as I've talked about it over the years, I feel like I haven't done enough, and we should all do a little bit more on that. But this is a very true statement, and as someone who's done this for a lot of years, and for the past 30 years, I've been able to make my living. I've been blessed. I've been able to make my living solely off of fishing in the fishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was smart enough. I'm not the smartest guy on earth, but I was smart enough to realize that what I was really seeking way back then, you're trying to find those spots where other people aren't fishing, like I mentioned, but also, you know, bodies of water that are good, that frankly up your odds, mm-hmm. that are healthy fisheries. Doesn't matter how good you are. You're really only as good as the health of the fishery that you're fishing. So I often say when I get on the conservation topic when I'm doing seminars, and I start off with a lot of you probably think this topic is boring, but this is actually the most important thing you can learn to catch more and bigger fish. And it's absolutely true, is that beyond the lures and the electronics and all of the different stuff, you really need to be good at the handling the fish and be prepared to land and have the proper tools, which includes a good net,
mm-hmm.
with proper mesh and all of the tools that you need to really handle it and get that fish off properly and quickly. And then also know how to hold a fish properly if you want to get some photos, just for any part of it. Proper hold is important. You still got to get the hooks out of the fish, get them out of the net and back into the water, even if you're not planning on taking a picture. So it's always been surprising to me to a certain extent of how many people will actually go out and pursue muskie or northern pike, or I guess maybe in a way any species, without having any idea or practice or research on what a proper hold is, and the fact that a supported hold for any species is, and the bigger they are and the heavier they are, the more important that becomes to be aware of how to get a proper gill hold and use a supported hold in a horizontal position as opposed to just dangling vertical with a gill hold or on some kind of a holding device. All of those things are extremely important. Just to go over the tools real quickly for muskie, some of them seem fairly common sense, but definitely pliers, a couple of pairs of needle nose pliers. And in the case of a muskie fish, and I recommend getting them big, the farther away that you can stay from the teeth. And then if the fish does ingest the lure a little bit, of course, the muskie's mouth is big, and you may need to go down into the mouth 4 to 5 inches to get at the fish in the case of a really, or the bait, the hooks, in the case of a really big muskie. So you want to get a minimum of 11-inch pliers and preferably even 14-inch pliers to be able to get at those hooks. And one thing that a lot of people don't think of that's extremely important is cutter. You got to have hook cutters, quality hook cutters that are going to be able to cut hooks up to 7-aught. We've got some really big baits that are used for muskie fishing these days, 7-aught, 8-aught hooks. And there's other items out there, but still to this day, I believe the absolute best tool is the Nipex Cobalt Cutters. They will cut anything and they last long, all the way up to 8 and even 10-aught hooks, something that'll be able to cut those hooks. Now, one thing that's not real popular with muskie fishing, but yet you could probably get away without cutters if you're willing to go barbless. Most people still fish with barbs these days, But if you went barbless, most likely you probably won't need cutters. I still recommend it, period. But with these bigger hooks and barbs, they can get stuck in there pretty good. And then you've got obviously areas that you do not want to yank a barbed hook out, even if you're able to get at it and do it. And those areas would be anywhere near the gill area. Gill arches themselves are where the gills join with the lower jaw there. Obviously, in the eye, anything like that, that's where going barbless actually really helps there. But if you have a barbed hook, if you're using barbed hooks and they're near any critical area like that, if I see a fish coming in before it's even netted and I see a hook in or near an eye or in or near that gill area anywhere, immediately my brain, I'm telling somebody we're going to need the hook cutters before that fish even gets netted. That just should automatically register if that's what you want to do, because you definitely don't want to tear back out of any kind of areas like that. And then if you do catch, let's say you've got a bait with 5-aught hook and you catch a smaller muskie or a smaller northern pike or hybrid, whatever it is, that you don't want to damage that fish. If in the corner of the mouth, obviously that's jaw strength right there on a smaller fish, especially with the bigger barbed hooks. If you just grab that with the pliers and yank it out, you may disfigure that. And there's not saying it's going to kill the fish, but it could definitely affect it as far as jaw strength and eating. So you should really be aware of that. Anybody that's going out with bigger baits and bigger hooks should have a bolt cutters without any doubt at all.
Yeah, and the other thing too is, especially this time of year, you alluded to it a little bit earlier, the heat can absolutely kill those fish just because it's so hot. And if you're prolonging the fight on the fish or keeping them out of water, it's also really detrimental. Can you touch on just some of the best practices for July and August?
We had about 3 weeks of, in my opinion, totally unsafe conditions to even fish for them. There's something about it, and I've never been big on trying to explain the science of it, because there's a lot of different factors that could come in. Originally, we hear about the lactic acid buildup and lower dissolved oxygen in the surface. And I think fish, when their metabolism is higher, and of course, they're cold-blooded critters, so when the water's warmer, the warmer it gets, the higher their metabolism is. I think they require a lot more oxygen, and there's something about fight stress and these different things. But I just know, getting totally beyond the science with all the experiences that I've had, is in my region, my latitude anyway, when I get up to starting the lower 70s, I'm thinking, okay, already we need to definitely try and minimize the bite time and time out of the water. I tell people that it's most likely safe to still fish for them from the mid-70s on up to 80. There's no exact rules to a certain extent. You got to see how the fish are reacting. If you're pushing the temperature limits, the fish are telling you how they're dealing with things. You can tell by the way they, if you're doing it, and I would definitely not recommend to anyone new to the sport to start fishing right in hot water. That's just really a recipe for disaster. You want to definitely start in the lower ranges where the fish are going to be a little more healthy, but after you've handled a few, you can literally see by the way the fish react by the time you've unhooked them. And if you go through the process of actually holding one up for a photo and then dropping them back in the water, they're in a lot of cases in these higher water temperatures, you can just tell they don't even want to stay upright. If you do hold them upright, they're not going to want to paddle off, and you got to spend a long time reviving, or worse that could happen is they may actually die on you right there. But in those upper 70 ranges, I personally got to where I do water release only, and I refuse to have any hold up photos or anything like that. A release picture is actually just fine, and that's where I generally will actually go barbless for sure and just shake them off by the side of the boat. In my personal experience in our area, the 80 degree range. And I should specify this. Don't be immediately panicked if you see 78 or 80 degrees in a situation where you've got extremely calm water and a blazing sun type of thing. You can get false readings. This should be where you figure the upper part of the water column is all in that range, which is what we experienced. We had the top, the top 15, 20 feet of the water column was up in the high 70s this year in June right away. And that when they can't get out of that temperature, and especially if you bring them up from deeper, cooler water into that, it's just really a shock factor. Now, I've talked with a lot of people, too, that fish down a little bit further south. It makes sense to me that maybe the 80 plateau is what I've set for myself. But in areas like Tennessee or Kentucky or wherever, if the average water temperature is higher in general over the course of the summer, it makes sense to me that those fish acclimate to that. And maybe I'd never like to say there's absolutely a set temperature for all areas. But observe the fish and read the fish as the way they're reacting to the fight and any handling as the water temperature are warming. And frankly, it's always told me over the years when it's just time to start being careful or time to stop. You can tell the way the fish reacts to it. And it's just not worth it to me anyway, to take a chance on killing the fish. And then when the water's real hot, you're just going to, I don't care who you are, you will not be able to successfully release a lot of these fish. The other thing that I should point out is just because you have a fish swim away does not mean that fish is okay. I found that out the hard way years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When I was first really experiencing that, I'd been observing the way the fish react. I'd had one die, and then I went to a hold-up policy, all-water release policy, and I still had fish that seemed lethargic, just not recuperating well, not swimming off strong. I had one that swam off after reviving it for a while, and it swam off. It definitely went down. It definitely stayed down. I hung around for a half hour, went about my day, came back the next day. The fish had particular markings. I know I found my fish the next day dead. Mm-hmm. And I found out since in talking to a lot of guys, biologists about this, and then one good buddy of mine, Mark Thorpe, that's been involved in a multitude of tracking studies out in Quebec, and where they've literally had transmitters in these fish, and so they know they can follow them around. And in that same temperature range that I was talking about, where I say you really got to be careful, they 75 up to 80, a lot of these fish that they had swim away would actually turn up dead several days later. And they don't all float. That was the scariest thing to me. This is proven by hagfish with transmitters. When they stop moving, they know something's wrong, and they're finding them on the bottom. According to Mark, for every fish, he said 90% won't gas up and float. So for every fish we see floating during a hot water period dead from mishandling, obviously there's, I'm sure it's not exact, but there's probably 8 or 9 other fish that have perished from mishandling as well. So
wow.
It's a real serious issue, and there's no denying that it occurs. If somebody said, Pete, I'm going to give you $50,000 for every dead muskie you can find, I'm going out looking for dead muskies whenever the water's the hottest. I absolutely know, and every year you see it. Because I have been involved in conservation issues for so long, I get maybe better idea than just about anybody on the planet of when things are really going wrong, because everybody feels like they have to tell me when there's a dead muskie. And it was unbelievable in late June and early July. I had people from all over, and it even got warm up in Canada. Even though Canada's closed, obviously Canadians were still musky fishing up there, and it was like it was coming from everywhere. All at once. Oh, found a dead one, found 3 floaters here. There's no doubt about it that heat is a real serious thing, and I believe that's pretty much with every species, whether it's whitefish or walleyes or bass. I mean, it's way more common to see dead fish that obviously died either immediately or from delayed mortality during the high heat.
Yeah, I think the only species that I see that handle it fairly well are carp and catfish. Some of your tougher fish like that, they seem to handle it. But you're right, I've seen it with walleyes, and trout are extremely susceptible. You catch a trout in the middle of summer and try to release it, it's pretty tough, especially if you have to get it out of the water. Yeah. So, yeah, no, that's a good point. I think about the inexperience factor, because you talked about it earlier. You have fish that's already a low density fish, so there's not very many. And so when someone catches one and just they've got it out of the water for 5 minutes to get their social media post and their picture and then put it back in, and then it's dead within a few minutes because it's just totally expired at that point. But I think it is important for people to understand the handling procedures and what they should be thinking about if they want to have more of them around.
Yeah, and I've seen over the years, that's why I just stopped doing it. Can't enjoy it. Totally ruins it for me. If I, even a fish that eventually takes off, if that fish has a doubt in my mind that it made it, it ruins it. That's just like what we were talking about earlier, screwing up and messing up a big fish or something like that. I'd rather not catch it. It ruins the experience for me, so I just stopped. I stopped all filming of muskies with John Gillespie and some of the stuff that I still do with my YouTube. I just refuse to do it because the other thing is you're trying to show the joy of fishing when you're doing the fishing show.
Mm-hmm.
And I can read it in myself. When I have doubts about the health of the fish, you can just tell I'm gone. I'm not myself. It's really interesting in watching my own videos over the years. That was one of the things that convinced me to get away from. It's not a good situation all around. One other thing I should mention too is the out of water handling and any extra handling when you get in the in between range, the higher water temperatures in the upper 70s that I talked about. It's so important to minimize that time out of water, and a standard procedure in recent years has been getting precise measurements with bump boards.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very precise way of getting a measurement, but it's generally done in the boat. And when you're talking critical temperatures, it's gotten to be somewhat of a standard procedure with people. If you are going to musky fish in the mid-70s or so, I really recommend not getting those measurements anymore, especially if they're in boat. It's number one, it's obviously extra time out of the water. But what can happen, and even with people that are good at handling fish, a certain percentage of those fish, when you go to lay them down on a bump board, when they lose that vision in the eye, they'll get excited and react negatively and start thrashing at that point. Especially with people that aren't real used to handling muskies and pike, they might lose control of that fish. And if it's a warm water period and you lose control of that fish on the floor of the boat, I'll guarantee it's dead. Even if you do get it to swim away, that's just about an absolute there. So it's just really, if you're going to fish in those kind of in-between ranges where it's risky, I really highly recommend just don't worry about how long that fish is. It's really not going to change anything about your experience, and there's certainly no need to know down to a half an inch. There's floating rulers. There's lots of different ways. If you've handled quite a few fish, frankly, you can guess.
Yeah.
Quite closely anyway, but boy, the trend of getting exact measurements is fine, I understand, but you really want to avoid that because it's just extra time and extra handling when the water gets warm.
Yeah, I saw a guy, he had a kind of a neat system. He took a piece of, I think it was 1-inch diameter PVC pipe, and he made it, I think it was like 65 inches long or something like that, and he filled it with foam so it would float. And then he would set it into the water next to the fish just to get a general idea. That would serve the purpose just fine.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Yeah. Floating 60 inch from a whole bunch of them years ago. I always keep a floating ruler in the boat if I happen to have somebody that hasn't caught it, really excited about actually seeing it. I usually end up teasing them because I tell them it's 41 or whatever I think it is. And then we measure it and it's within an inch of what I said anyway, but that is definitely a much safer way to do it. And that way the fish is in the water upright, the position they're supposed to be. And, you know, you're still going to be able to get a measurement and you're not doing any damage to the fish that way.
Yeah. And that for those of us out here in the West, it's really important to have a successful release because we have sterile muskies. They're hybrids and they put them in and they live for, 10, 11 years and they die. They have a fairly short lifespan. So getting those fish successfully back into the water is very important here, just because back where you are, they can spawn, but here they can't. So it's even more critical in Wyoming, Utah, Montana, Colorado, places that have tiger muskie populations, to have that successful release as well, because if we don't have any fish.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that takes a long time.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of cases, the further north you go, the longer it takes. The lifespan's longer, but so's the growth. If you're taking a 50-inch muskie out of the picture in the northern latitudes, you're talking 20 years. Yeah, you might have a fish in the water to replace it, either by natural reproduction or stocking, but it's 20 years before it gets that big again. And obviously, yeah, we all'd like to catch a bigger one. So, yeah, it takes a long time, and it's really important. And I should point out that I'm aging myself here, but I started when catch and release hadn't even occurred. The first 4 years of guiding, it was just standard procedure. I never thought any differently. Our size limit was 32 inches. Wow. I finally wised up because of a buddy from Muskies Inc., and we started releasing them. It's embarrassing to tell that story. He actually suggested release, and I thought, you don't release those things. And he says, would you rather catch a big one? Yeah, I'd like to catch a big one. And they get a little older when you let them go, and they get bigger. And embarrassingly, I hadn't really thought of that. That's a pretty good idea. And I started releasing the fish, but boy, I'll tell you what, growing up in those days with a 32-inch size limit, I can tell you that very few fish snuck through, because it was an absolute rarity to get a fish over 40 inches in those days. That was a monster. And once in a while, you get the freak fish that, I think in those days, those were just females that for whatever reason were wired into fishing open water or staying in open water and feeding on open water forage. So you'd get some of those fish that would stay out there, and they wouldn't get targeted because people didn't know about fishing deep water ranges and suspended fish in those days. So a few would make it. But that size limit, you catch your legal killing fish from about 32 to 34, 35. And the majority of the fish never got much bigger than that, because we killed them. That's just what we saw. It was horrible comparatively, especially size structure-wise in those days. And when catch and release started, there was no denying it. People around here that were like, no way, I'm not going to do it at first. Even the most hard-headed had to admit it after a while. It was a gradual process. But you just started seeing it work. And then they started installing some 40-inch size limits in some places. And next thing, there was quite a few of those 41, 42s, but not much over.
Yeah.
It was interesting. And it all came together, some higher size limits, and to this day, pretty much 100% catch-and-release mentality. And that's why the topic now that's the most important is most people are willing to release, but they aren't necessarily aware of how to do it properly, the tools and everything we've talked about, and then that you really got to be careful in that hot water.
Right.
We get those things solved, and you're still going to lose fish. There's no way that we'll ever get to the point of 100% success with catch and release, because some fish are going to swallow a bait, and once in a blue moon, I've even seen that in the cold water. They will have I'm not sure if it's a heart attack or what it is, but I've had a couple of fish over the years that showed up dead. I'm not sure what even happened to them. You get them in the net and they're not bleeding. They're not, I don't know what it is, frankly, but apparently they can experience a heart attack or something like that as well. Cause I've had it happen twice. And one time it was 34 degree water in late November when I had to break ice to get out on the lake. There was no damage to that fish at all. And you could see something. I remember thinking something was wrong when I got the fish in the net, looking at its eyes. No problem getting the bait out. Pulled it out of there, and it was gone. Just over.
Wow. Yeah, and things have changed over the last, I would say, 10 years, and you've seen this too, around the country. As far as muskies are concerned, there are a lot more, I guess you would say, strict regulations as far as lengths, what the size limit is. And here in Wyoming, up until, gosh, I think it was 4 years ago, Danny, he really pushed to change the regulations, because that was, you could have three per day and they had to be over 30 inches long. Tiger muskies, they grow really fast. And if you get a guy who knows what he's doing on tigers on a good day, can catch three. And if he keeps coming back and doing that over and over again, you don't have a tiger muskie fishery. And it's a bad deal on a couple of fronts. It's bad for the anglers because the fish are gone. And then it's also bad for the biologists who had them stocked to control white suckers and carp because now the predator gone. And so it's a double whammy on the taxpayer and on the fishermen. But I feel like it's getting a lot better now in Wyoming. They have to be a minimum of 36 inches and you can only have one. I know Utah, a couple of years ago, they went to a catch and release only. And it's been good to see that just because if you want to catch a monster, you got to put them back, just like you're saying. The other thing I wanted to ask is, what are the biggest do's and don'ts of muskie fishing? And I know for me, I learned the hard way. I told the story about pulling the bait out of one's mouth earlier. So now I try to remind myself, don't set the hook until you fill them. Don't set the hook till you fill them. But what are some other things that, you know, for novice muskie fishermen, that when they do get that follow or when they do have that fish strike, what are some do's and don'ts?
Muskies love to follow any other water fish, the boat, without a doubt, figure eight or either way. Change of direction, which I believe is what makes the figure eight or oh work by the side of the boat. I believe it's a reaction, just my guess, related that the prey, now you're there and you're eat me, and it's trying to get away. And that's the response that you want to try and trigger in that fish. That's why going fast in circles on a figure eight, I think, is really what makes things happen. It's an evasive maneuver by prey, and it'll trigger the fish, in a lot of cases, to strike. Seeing a follow, though, polarized glasses is an absolute, and training yourself to be watching behind and below the lure, and looking for any kind of color changes or anything that could possibly indicate a fish is coming. And depending on the lure type that you have, that's one variable a lot of people don't really consider, is every lure is a little different on how you might be able to trigger a fish. But one thing I always tell people is, with every different lure type, you should be able to answer this question in your head at that point. What are you going to do if you see a follow? Try and trigger a fish, mm-hmm. because it's extremely important. One thing that's maybe the best over the years for me is a zigzag type maneuver before I even get to the boat. If I know that fish is coming, it's very effective with spinners, crankbaits. You can't do it quite as well generally with a jerkbait, but you want to do something to trigger that fish. Make it think you're aware of it and you're trying to get away, or the lure's trying to get away. Having an idea of something, even if it's wrong, is real important, because people tend to freeze otherwise if they don't have that idea in the head of what they're going to trigger that fish. And when I hit people with that, in a lot of cases, they can't answer it.
Yeah.
They'll put on a jerk bait, or they'll put on it. What are you going to do? Are you going to give it a wild jerk and pause? Are you going to twitch it three times and pause? Are you going to speed up? What are you going to do? And in a lot of cases, people don't have that answer. So that's one thing to do in your own mind. And there's so many different variables that you have. Some baits are way more buoyant than others. That can be a real effective thing, by the way, to stop a lure and let it float up. Mm-hmm. But if it doesn't float up or it's neutral. But anyway, you got to have an idea of what you're going to do. Because if you can get that fish to trigger before you get to the boat, your odds actually go up. It's generally better to get them to hit out there and you'll be able to see it, get a good hook set, and you'll be able to fight the fish a little bit better. So generally, speeding up is going to be a better thing with a topwater lure or a spinner type bait. If you've got a real buoyant bait, in a lot of cases, some real erratic twitches, and then just killing the bait and letting it slowly rise up will be effective as well. But then be thinking all the time, if that doesn't work, obviously, then you may want to try and make a real fast maneuver towards the boat from there. And then as far as there's a million things I could say, but the figure eights and O's should be practiced by the side of the boat. That's extremely important too. Now you have, obviously, with crankbaits, you've got all different types of lips. So there's different, every lure is different in the speed you're able to maintain in a circle, and the amount of line from the rod tip to the lure. In a lot of cases, just the leader is all you need. But in a lot of cases, too, a deeper diving bait, you may want to have 2 feet of line total out, just the way that bait swings in the circle. But you should practice your boat side maneuvers, especially if it's a lure that you haven't used before. Get an idea of what you would do. Imagine that muskie is already there before you get in that situation, and you don't have any time to think, and especially if you haven't done it a whole lot and you're likely to freak out. Having practiced the circle and the eight by the side of the boat before you get a fish to come, it's just huge. It really is. Make sure you can do a good circle or an eight with the bucktail without those blades stopping. The corners should be as wide as possible. Practice all of that. When you're doing a circle maneuver with your bait, make sure you come in close to the gunwale so you're able to stretch out as far as possible on those corners and make a big circle. The corners are generally key. That's where the strikes are going to occur, is on the corner. And if you have not practiced it with the different lure types, you have the lure fly right out of the water. If you're not aware of coming close to the gunwale,
mm-hmm.
you're going to stretch. I've seen this a million times. People see the fish coming. They don't come close to the gunwale, and they're excited, and they just start pulling the lure, and they get stretched way out over on the side, and the fish hasn't hit yet, and they just come straight back or stop. They're basically handcuffed. They got no place to go. Fish doesn't know what to do. The fish is embarrassed. The angler's embarrassed. It's not a good deal. You really want to practice the eights and O's before a fish comes with every lure. And that way you have an idea what you can and can't do, and it really makes a difference.
Biggest, I'll tell you this story. It's kind of embarrassing to tell the muskie legend this story, but I'm going to tell you anyway. But Danny took me fishing this one time, and it was the day that I caught my first muskie. So it was a successful day, but this part of the story is a little bit embarrassing. So we were fishing, and I was trying this big spinnerbait, and the one thing I had not learned yet was to pay attention, like you said, to what's below, behind, and watching your lure come up to you as you're coming to the boat to watch for follows and whatnot. And I just was in typical Wyoming fishing boy, just throwing retrieve and not really paying attention. And so he said something to me, and I picked up my bait out of the water, and I turned to look at him, and a tiger muskie jumped over my Minn Kota trolling motor out of the water to try to grab my bait because I hadn't left it in the water in front of him, and I hadn't been paying attention, and he missed, but it scared the crap out of me. And it wasn't a big one. It was probably a mid 30-inch fish, but it scared the crap out of me, and it got my attention, I'll tell you that. So after that, it was about 20 minutes later, I actually caught my first one on a figure eight on that lure next to the boat. But it was just so funny. That fish wanted that lure so bad, he jumped all the way over my trolling motor out of the water. It's just insane. And that's it. Yeah, and they're so athletic. Like, they're just an incredible fish. I don't think I've ever seen a fish with the speed that a muskie has, and I don't know if you can talk about that a little bit, but I've seen them cover a 10-foot area in a millisecond.
That's actually why, in a lot of cases, the people reaction to seeing a fish coming is they want to make it easier for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Worst reaction. That's why the speed up is for moving baits, I guess, in general, like a buck. Something I tell people to, and if that fish starts coming, go as you can, because you absolutely cannot keep it away from you. And if you trigger that response, if you get them to that next level, they will get it. And that's where the practice is, though. That's where the control, practicing that fast figure eight and being able to control it is so key. But that is really what will trigger them in a lot of cases. And yeah, when it comes to speed, they've got plenty of. There's no doubt. If they want it, they will get it. And it's probably one of the most effective ways to get them. Now, that sounds exactly the opposite with certain baits, especially floaters. But sometimes killing it and letting it rise will be the deal as well. But if there's a most consistent thing to try with any lure, it's just flat speed. I've seen it work with soft plastics as well. The general reaction in the figure eight with those would be I'll generally keep them erratic and watch and see how that fish is responding. In a lot of cases, you can get them to eat it right after a jerk and a pause, and they'll do that. But if nothing else is working, I've had it work with and bulldogs and different baits where you just all of a sudden decide, okay, I'm going to treat this like a bucktail, and you don't twitch or do anything. You just rip it around in a circle as fast as you can, and all of a sudden you see that attitude of that fish change. You can almost see them get stupid, right? Just looking at their eyes is a neat feeling. I've called the shot a lot of times, rarely been wrong, where right before it happens, I'll be like, that one's going to do it, because you can just see it click in, man, and there. Especially when it's that speed deal that triggers them there. You might not get them. They're going to try. Right. There is no way they're not going to do it. And I got a funny story. I stole the 52-incher from a guy one time. I've never seen big fish going that fast and that excited. And what was really weird about it is we probably hadn't seen a fish in 4 hours. It was fall and dreary conditions for muskies anyway. Sunny, no wind. And all of a sudden, this fish comes up out of the blue on a crankbait. It looks pretty active, and this guy just got excited. He was actually a darn good fish, but he did exactly what I was talking about with not doing the corners. He wasn't really staying close to the gunwale, and he'd race off to the side, and then he'd basically just do a 180 and come right back. And I've got a spinnerbait that was out three quarters of the way yet, and I'm watching all of this, and I'm coaching them, and I'm like, corners, you got to go wider. And this muskie, they usually, if they miss once, they generally get embarrassed and swim away. Not this one. He got a mouthful of water. I should say she, I'm sure. But it missed on the far corners at least three times. Was trying. About the time he'd come to the end of his rope, and then he'd do the 180 and come back. Poor fish had missed. And it was so funny. I'm like, I didn't actually say it, but I had been coaching him. And I see, here's my spinnerbait coming. And I just swung that right in front of him. All of a sudden, that fish saw that. And I just swung it right in front of his nose. That's what you get.
Yep, that's the way it goes. So if you could share just like one of your top stories of musky fishing success, maybe your proudest moment, what would it be? I like to ask hard questions on here.
Yeah, that is a tough one. It was really the proudest moment. My buddy wasn't all that excited about it. This was actually more of a fluke. I found out there was an individual rock a few days later, but the reason I got this fish. But a lot of folks may be aware of the name Dick Pearson. He's an icon of mine, one of the pioneers of Canadian shield fishing. And he and Doug Johnson were the guys that you started hearing about muskies years ago, Fisherman Days.
Yep.
And both guys are just tremendous pioneers, and I've been blessed over the years to fish with both of them and get to know both of them real well. And I was fishing with Dick Pearson up in Canada, and we're exploring a new lake, and we're fishing this rock bar, kind of a long, thin piece, and we got a big fish on one end of the reef. And one thing that I'll suggest, just to quickly digress, people always ask me, do you come back on a fish right away or not? And I generally try and make a judgment on whether or not a window is opening or closing. And that's just recent activity type of thing. So in other words, if you've already had somewhat of a window and then you raise a really big fish after 20 minutes or so, or a fish you want to catch, doesn't matter how big. Common sense tells me that I'm probably getting to the end of the feeding window. In that case, I'm probably going to leave that fish alone because I think I'm just going to educate it to all my lures. Now, on the other hand, if we've had a slow period and I feel like we're just coming into it, then I'm generally going to get back at that fish right away. In this particular case, I felt like weather-wise and stuff with Dick, we're like, before we leave, we better go back on that fish and give him a try. Funny thing is, we never saw that fish, but I had a trolling motor that was giving me fits at the time and not stowing very well, so I'd It was one that you could just lift up. So I said to Pearson, I said, Dick, just lift that motor up and I'll idle over there. We'll get a little north of the fish and we'll come back at him from a different angle. And he did that. And he's standing up there on the deck holding my trolling motor up. And I start idling along and I think I'm idling. I guess I might as well fish. I had a bucktail and I pitched it out the back of the boat. I bet that blade spun about 2 seconds. And I had I believe it was a 51. Anyway, they hit it immediately.
Wow.
And he's standing there holding that trolling motor.
Hitting man.
Here's the thrashing back there.
Man.
And I got this great big fish. And then he went into this routine about, I see how you are. Get me holding this trolling motor. And then you're fishing.
Yeah, I bet you'll never live that one down.
I'll tell you what, it was a long 3 days, the next 3 days fishing with him. He reminded me about that about every 10 minutes, I think.
That's what good fishing buddies do. They don't let those things go. Right. One last thing that I know you've got things to get to, but the passion for this podcast is really about getting our young people and for me, like my spouse and different people like that, more involved in fishing and really trying to mentor the next generation. So if you could just give any kind of advice to our listeners on how to maybe approach getting somebody to be involved in muskie or pike fishing, that would be awesome.
Oh, yeah, and to get good at the handling aspect and be aware of those things and keep the fisheries healthy, because there's one thing about it, if you're going to get anybody involved, young to old, it's a lot more fun when the bobber's down. If you know, that is truly all about the health of the fisheries. You can't catch stuff that isn't there, so that's real important as well. But then the other thing I would say is you know, read the fish or the fish. Read the people to a certain extent, like I talk about reading the fish. You're going to have, when you get, especially young people out for the first time, and be aware of their enjoyment of things. It's real easy as an adult and someone that's really into fishing to expect the people you're taking out to think like you and enjoy things like you do. And in some cases, it's all real good intentions, because you really want them to get into it and you really want them to catch a fish, you know, in most cases more than you would like to catch a fish yourself. You want to show them a good time and get them into it, but you really got to be aware of, you know, what the fish activity is and what the tolerance is of the person. If the kid is wired like me, that I the way I've been all my life, or the little girl I talked about at the start of the show that was on the dock on her own. But you get a person like that out there, they might go all day and want to fish even harder than you. But remember that it should be an enjoyable experience. Make sure there's plenty to do with kids. It's always good. Make sure they got plenty of liquids to drink and snacks. And just try and get them action, but definitely do not push things too far. That's one of the biggest mistakes I've seen over the years. And I was very aware from a guiding standpoint. Because a lot of people were trying to get their spouse or their kids or whatever into fishing by guiding. And there was a lot of cases where I even suggested, you could just see that in a lot of cases, they didn't want the kid or the new person to be able to take a break. They weren't really reading the enjoyment level and the intensity level. And definitely you don't want to push them far. If a bite's tough or something like that, you might want them to catch a fish, but that you wanting them to in the reality of the situation is a totally different thing. I obviously extend it when everything's going good, the fishing's going good, the person's enjoying it and still into it, but when they stop having a good time, it's time to stop. That's really the way I've always tried to deal with it. Now I've got a son who's 20 now, and he still likes He likes fishing with dad, and I got to say I'm fairly proud of the way I handle it over the years. He's not wired like me. He enjoys it, but he's not wired to be super into it. And that's one thing that I saw early on, and, you know, he's at college now. We don't see each other all that much, but he still really likes to go fishing and enjoys it very much. He's not an absolute hardcore, so we go out and I guess we know one another now at this stage, but one of the things I know I would have turned them off early on if I would have done what I felt like I wanted to do at the time, me being a rabid angler, I would read my son, and when he wasn't into it anymore, I'd say, okay, that's enough. In some cases, I might drop him off and let him go do his thing and go back out, but I would never push it too far. And if it's going good, let them enjoy it. And if it's not going all that good and they're not into it anymore, definitely don't force it on them.
Sure.
That to me is real important. And I've seen it in a lot of cases, like I say, in the guiding days and stuff like that. Just make sure it's an enjoyable experience, and just means an awful lot to me.
Yeah. So for the audience, if they want to get more information on how to fish for muskies and more information on you, where do they go? And for those of you who are interested in some of these topics, like on handling muskies, what kind of gear to use, you can watch videos of Pete going through step by step what you should have, what you need. So definitely check out PeteMena.com so that you can get that information. And Pete, again, thank you so much for coming on today. I know I'm extremely grateful to have you on as somebody who I've been following and watching for around 20 years now. It's just super awesome to have you on here and get to visit with you and listen to you share your expertise with the rest of us. So thanks again for coming on. All right. And Yeah, absolutely. And for all the listeners, please, again, don't forget to check us out at radcastoutdoors.com. If you want to help the podcast and help spread it out to your friends, please go and share and subscribe. And we will come back again, hopefully shortly, and hear stories from David on his Northwest Territories hikes and hopefully hear a success story. So we will see you guys again next time. Thanks again for listening to the Radcast Outdoors podcast. We hope that you've enjoyed the show. If so, please go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Carbon TV, YouTube, or wherever you're listening to this podcast and subscribe, share, and give us a 5-star rating, which helps other people find the show. You can find all of our shows, recipes, giveaways, videos, and much more at radcastoutdoors.com. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We also have a Radcast community on Facebook called Radcast Nation. We'd love for you to join in the conversation there. And of course, please help support our sponsors who make this show possible. Thanks again to PK Lures, Bow Spider, and High Mountain Seasonings. Until next time, get out there and enjoy the outdoors.